The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool. And the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 175. I'm Sean.
I'm Dave.
And our special guests are Max Gladstone. Hello, Max.
Hello, Sean.
And David Levine.
Hello.
So, our sort of discussion today was going to be to start loosely on looking at a religion in science fiction and fantasy, which is a very broad topic. But that's, I think, going to be okay because we'll probably end up narrowing our focus in interesting ways as things jump out that interest us. So, since the three of you are primarily, you all have lovely writing careers, which is pretty awesome. I'm curious how each of you have actually approached dealing with religion of any form, whether it's, you know, like a real religion or one that you made up in your work. So to sort of start with you, Max, how have you actually dealt with religion in any of your work?
Well, in my first book, Three Parts Dead, which came out last year, it follows a junior associate in an international necromancy firm who's actually trying to resurrect a dead god. And in fact, the number of books that I'm writing that are set in the same world as that one are dealing with gods and their death, sort of resurrection occasionally, and the ways that people live both with and without them. So the themes of religion and dependence have been pretty significant in my work.
Excellent. What about you, David?
Well, I'm a short story writer. I've got about 50 stories, and they're widely varying between science fiction and fantasy. And some of the stories have religious themes, and some of them don't. Many of them don't. In some cases, the characters are religious, and in some cases, they are not. I'm personally an atheist, but I've given a lot of thought to questions of religion and the existence of God and the impact that religion has on societies and on individuals. And I've explored these in various ways in my published and unpublished works.
Interesting. So before I go to you, Dave, really quick question for both Max and David. Since you come from religion from different sort of perspectives, Max, it seems like you're dealing with sort of fictionalized, I like the necromancy kind of angle, which is kind of creepy but awesome at the same time. And David, you actually seem like you're very interested in how religion has actually affected society. So one of the things I'm curious about is, do you find as writers that that you have to tread a careful line when actually addressing religion? And maybe not in your case, Max, because you're dealing with necromancy, so... So I feel like that's a safe topic, but maybe not
not around necromancers.
Yeah, but why don't we start with you, David?
Well, yes, you do have to tread carefully, but on the other hand, science fiction and fantasy is a field that has had a long tradition of stepping on pretty heavy philosophical topics. And so there are plenty of people that never read it at all or would like to see it all banned. For example, I happen to know a writer who passed on a couple of years ago, whose family never liked what he had been doing as a science fiction writer. And so once he had passed on, they actually worked to suppress his writing. It's quite terrible. And a lot of science fiction and fantasy books have been banned from libraries and schools. But in general, I'd say that within the field, we're pretty open to all kinds of ethical and religious ideas. So I'm not too worried about it. Probably the scariest thing I've done recently as far as religion was I had a story called Second Chance. It's actually a novella that I just brought out as an ebook. And the main character of this one is a deeply religious person. This is somebody whose ideas and lifestyle are very different from mine. And I actually disagreed with the character. And the character was going to be somebody who was going to get into a lot of trouble because of his religious beliefs. And I wanted to make sure that although he would get into lots of trouble and suffer, because that's what we do to our characters, I wanted to make sure that I did not cop out. I did not want to make him a villain. I did not want to have him change his fundamental nature in terms of his belief in God. He just needed how to deal with, he needed to learn to deal with the people around him who had different beliefs without letting go of his own belief. And honestly, I'm not 100% sure how successful that was, because a lot of people have commented on this story that they find the main character unsympathetic. Excuse me. That they find the main character unsympathetic. He wasn't intended to be unsympathetic. Certainly he has his issues. Many characters do. But I think my attempt to get into the head of a character very different from myself in terms of his religious belief was not entirely successful.
Hmm. Interesting. What about you, Max?
Well, you're absolutely right, John, that I'm getting kind of a free pass when I'm working in secondary fantasy worlds, in that nobody is going to come up and say, you got this piece of doctrine wrong, or that doesn't look anything like my church, because frankly, the church in my book is a priesthood of a fire god, and there aren't a ton of those running around, though there are still a bunch of Zoroastrians. And anyway, so I'm not running as many risks of people saying you have violated my religious beliefs, or you're saying things that are anathema to my faith about my faith. So, you know, I'm not going to be in a Salman Rushdie situation, probably, unless there are some people who have very strange religious beliefs out there that are directly relevant to my work somehow. But I guess the question about stepping on toes deals a lot with the issue of what we're really talking about when we're talking about religion and religious faith. And it's very easy, I think, to get in trouble when we start dealing with real faiths that that exist in the world and addressing the truth claims they make, like saying, for example, that this certain thing which is said in your religious text is wrong, and I'm going to write a whole story about how that's wrong, or something like that. It's very easy to offend people in that way, and it's very easy to cross lines. When I'm working on stories in my worlds that are about religious characters, I try really hard to think about what the faith that they have means for them, not so much what particular truth claims they're making about like scientific fact or what we would think of as scientific fact, but how the religion that they operate within sets a context for the world, sets a context for their system of ethics. That means that it's pretty rare, at least in my stories, that characters are going to be running around having arguments about what factually happened 3,000 or 4,000 years ago and whether it's connected to, whether it's verified by archaeological fact or whatever. And it's much more that two characters with world systems that are very different and are structured by the context in which they were raised, a part of which is their religion, will be incapable or having a really hard time communicating with one another because their basic assumptions are just wrong or are incomprehensible, mutually incomprehensible.
That's an interesting take. So I know I've kept Dave quiet for so long. So based on kind of where we're jumping up here, do you want to jump in and just kind of offer your particular take?
Well, I know from my own experiences of late, it's been going in a couple of different directions, because with the Warhammer 40,000 fiction, there the religion is integral to the lives of the characters, at least the humans in that universe, and it's part of the dystopian nightmare that is that universe. And so whereas on the one hand it is a made-up one. It has very strong echoes. The iconography is sort of very familiar from with the Gothic churches and so forth. So and when someone like, say, Dan Abnett introduces lines in coming from a clear satanic or Judas figure that are also the lines that we hear from Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane or on Golgotha, there you start getting resonances and echoes there that are you get almost a combination of the secondary world and the real one. And in my original fiction, in the horror fiction, there I'm jumping right into real world religions, and yeah, the possibility of toe stepping is very much present, and it becomes a on the one hand, I think what both Max and David were saying, I agree with you. I want the characters who have these particular beliefs to be very sympathetic, but on the other hand, with at least supernatural horror, the fiction is making a truth claim about their truth claims. And that can lead to some very dark conclusions.
What do you mean when you say dark conclusions?
Well, because it's the same. I don't know if we're speaking hypothetically, right? If you look at, say, the Lovecraftian universe, which has an explicitly non-Christian cosmology, just to put it simply. Now, if you then place a Christian character in that universe, where the belief systems are explicitly contradicted by that universe, then you can see how that would raise eyebrows or hackles in some readers.
Yeah, because it kind of goes to what I was saying earlier about that this concern about stepping on toes. I mean, how does one approach an idea like that, where you take an existing religion and you put a character in a situation where their belief system is directly challenged? And you could even have, I guess, to some extent, you could do this with a secondary fantasy world in which you could have one character of one religion find out that actually their version of God doesn't exist. It's actually, you know, a fish god. Right. So in Max's world, maybe there is no fire god and he turns out to be a monkey. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But even I guess maybe there's something safer about dealing with religions that don't actually exist than it would be to switching it around and taking, you know, somebody of, as you said, David, like Christian faith, and stick them in a position where everything they understand about their faith is suddenly false. And I'm not sure there's an easy answer to how can anyone think of any examples in which fiction has any science fiction or fantasy text has actually taken an existing religion and made a truth claim about its own truth claims in the negative, in the sense of saying that whatever claim it is false, and has done it particularly well?
If you want to call Satanic Verses work of science fiction or fantasy, which I think you probably could based on the demons and so forth that show up within it, then it's kind of the archetype example of this sort of thing going horribly wrong, isn't it, right?
And horror does it all the time. In a science fiction context, I'm thinking of maybe something like Arthur C. Clarke's The Star raises some difficult issues.
Although Arthur C. Clarke's The Star doesn't actually go into the question of whether or not God exists.
No, that's true.
The thing is that there's two characters in this star. There's the scientist and the priest. And the scientist sees that this supernova existed and calculates that it must have been the light that reached Earth and just in time to become the Star of Bethlehem. And the problem the priest has to struggle with is within his own belief system, he has to believe that God destroyed this entire civilization, a civilization of beautiful and kind people, in order to produce the light. And so the question is, he's left with the question of, did God really do this? And if so, how does that change my relationship with him? Or alternatively, did God not do this? In which case, well, what do I believe? So I believe the question is left open at the end of the story. Although not at the end of the television adaptation of the story, which was turned into an explicitly positive message.
Well, there's an adaptation of that. I didn't know that.
I think it was on the new Outer Limits or the new Twilight Zone, one of those in the 80s?
Oh, okay. That would have been, I think, the Twilight Zone, because I think the new Outer Limits was the 90s, wasn't it? I don't know. I don't remember. I remember watching the new Outer Limits and being slightly terrified of that a number of times. But I was young, you know, so give me a break, right? I think that's very interesting that if we think of something like The Star, where I guess what makes that interesting is what seems to be an ambiguous ending. That there's actually a quote unquote truth claim being made, in the sense that what is being understood is what had happened, you know, according to, I guess, the biblical text, right, has now changed by the addition of new information, and that you're now presented with a new dilemma, which is, you know, which version is actually the one that I guess perhaps causes the least problems in terms of a crisis of faith. Because mm-hmm. in that example, right, you know, one example is that God actually chose to destroy an entire civilization just to send a sign to Earth, which seems rather sadistic. I mean, just to be kind of brutal about it, I mean, I guess it would be sadistic from a human perspective, because none of us are God. I hope not.
Well, I am.
Or all of us are.
We're all God. But
I'm Brian, and so is my wife.
But I find that dilemma the kind of interesting thing, and I do think that's one thing that's that I think is really fascinating about religion in genre fiction, in any context, even when it's just fake, you know, like made up religions, are the kinds of dilemmas it presents for morality and ethics, whether it's in the case of The Star, in which it's actually a character, you know, going through a kind of crisis and trying to figure out, like, what does all of this mean now? Or, you know, in terms of, you know, what does one do when the gods actually literally exist and you can touch a god, right? At what point does one choose to do one action over another in that kind of a context? Does one just blindly follow a actual god or not? Because it's a little bit different, I guess, than living in a world where, you know, people believe God exists, but, you know, God isn't hanging out at the bar on the weekend.
There are a lot of science fiction stories that have some god other than our god exposed as being a machine or a giant lizard or an earth scientist or some such. Microcosmic God by Sturgeon. The Star Trek episode with David Soul as the green guy with the antennae, and the god was a giant lizard, or was it actually a giant computer system? There's lots of cases in which the human Christian main characters come in and show the benighted natives that their god is actually not really a god. And that's a very comforting kind of a story. But I think what we're most interested in here is stories where that turns it around, and the character in the story comes and presents us with evidence that our god is not what we had thought.
Indeed. So I see, Max, you had your hand up first, so why don't you jump in?
Oh, sure. A good example from fantasy, from a sort of secondary world of fantasy, actually comes out of Terry Pratchett, right? There's the golem cop, Durfel, I think is his name, in one of the books, who's an avowed atheist, in spite of the fact that the Discworld is crawling with gods, and it's very difficult to walk down the street without running into two or three of them just getting coffee. And, of course, since this character is a golem, he's immune to most forms of damage. So the gods smite him on a regular basis, but it hasn't convinced him of anything yet, because he just sort of shrugs off the lightning bolt. this whole question about new information coming to light, new shit has come to light, man, that's sort of shaking people's faith in science fiction and fantasy is really interesting, because it's been a big issue in theology, especially sort of Protestant kind of German existentialist theology from the beginning of the last century, or the sort of 20s and 30s. A guy named Rudolf Bultmann wrote this really cool series of articles on the New Testament and myth, in which he basically said, look, we can think of religion as making all of these sort of scientific truth claims, like the world is organized in three tiers, and there's sort of a heaven tier up in the sky, and there's a hell tier underneath, and there's all of us here on the earth, and it behaves in these ways according to these rules. And for one thing, we can look around and see a whole bunch of religions in which that's true. So it means that there's not all that much in, say, sort of this Protestant Christianity that that is unique, that sort of separates us from everything else. And there's another way in which we can look at it and say, well, there's obviously not a heaven tier. We can go up into the sky with rockets and see that there's nothing up there. It's not in the clouds. So what's there? And if you hold too fast to the notion of what the truth claim, of like the significance of the truth claim, then you start to get into this doublethink territory where you're believing both that there is something up in the sky and that there's not anything up in the sky, or there is something up in the sky in one sense and it's really there, but it's not there. And then you start sort of grasping at fact. And the question that he raises is this what religion should be about? In general, should be running around and grasping at facts, or is there something more going on, or at least different going on?
Well, I think the 21st century view of religion is that religion is viewed as something more than a metaphor and something other than an explanation for how the world actually works. Because for, I think probably ever since the Bible was written, new information has been coming to light showing that things are not exactly as they were described, not in a literal way. Mm-hmm. And so we've been in this constant process of reinterpretation, while some quarters are also continuing to insist that their reinterpretation is not a reinterpretation, that it is truth and has always been truth, and no, I haven't changed my mind. And it's a mindset that is, it's not the same as the scientific mindset, because the scientific mindset is all about changing your mind in response to new facts. Mm-hmm. And I think the religious mindset is not so much changing the facts to respond to the beliefs as changing the interpretation of facts, or changing the meaning of the facts, or the impact of the facts on your life, allowing the belief. Because the thing about belief, of course, is that belief is defined as believing that something is true despite the fact that there's no evidence. If you have evidence, then that's not belief anymore. It's just fact finding. And so I think all religion is based around believing things that you cannot prove are true. And it's only a short step from there to believing things that you can prove are not true, but in a religious sense, somehow they're truer than mere facts. They're more important to individuals.
Dave, you had your hand up a minute ago. Do you want to jump in on everything that's been said so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think the line we keep coming back to about new information has come to light underscores the tension that I think exists in particular the science fictional approaches to religion, in that exactly as David was just describing, that difficulty between facts and belief, and that they're the problem when you try to mix them too closely together, right? I.e., religion seeking proof of its truth claims in facts, which then starts getting away from the question of belief. And so in the example of the star, right, we have on the one hand evidence which would seem to support a biblical story, but then raises very uncomfortable questions. And there's another story that unfortunately both the author and the title escape me. I'm going to have to dig it up. It was from the mid-80s, if memory serves, where a scientist is hired to perform experiments on the Shroud of Turin, and is able to confirm that in fact it does indeed have the blood of someone who would have been alive at precisely the right time and location as Christ. Unfortunately, he also discovers a genetic flaw in the blood, which indicates that this individual had delusions of grandeur and megalomania and a god complex, right? which is not welcome information. That is information, new information coming to light that is not welcome. So it simultaneously confirms and yet undermines the system. And so I guess the last thing that I was picking up from David about the truths that are somehow beyond facts, it's making me think of Werner Herzog's term of the ecstatic truth, right? The truth that is somehow more important that we get through art, and perhaps therefore also through beliefs or certain type or faith for some of us that have a value beyond what we can empirically prove.
Mm-hmm. That gets into something that China Mieville said that I think is relevant to this. He talks about the numinous, mm-hmm. He talks about he was talking about the difference between fantasy and science fiction, but I think it's relevant to the discussion of science versus religion as well. The numinous is something that has that sense of wonder or mystery to it. And if you're writing something and you explain everything about how it works, then that's not really fantasy anymore. That's science fiction. And conversely, if you have something that the people who are using it don't understand how it's used, don't understand how it works, then it has that sense of mystery to it, and therefore it becomes more fantastical and less science fictional. And the same thing is true in reality. You talked about people who have to deal with gods that are walking down the street and you can't buy a cup of coffee without bumping into two or three of them. In that case, are those really gods, or are they just very powerful beings? You know, isn't a god something that is more than just somebody who's bigger than you and can make you do whatever he wants because he's more powerful than you? You know, isn't a god something that is beyond mortal ken and not just bigger and fancier than us? And I think that's something that that's a way in which religion has changed over the past couple of thousand years, in that I think the Greeks and the Romans and a lot of the other people back a couple thousand years ago conceived the gods as being just like people, only more powerful. But as we've learned more about the universe and we've discovered that such beings do not physically exist, now we have more and more religions considering a god as being some kind of moral force, some kind of driver, something philosophical rather than something physical.
So, well, it's interesting because we go all the way back to Plato's Republic and we can see that initial tension there too. And when Socrates is talking about the Iliad and the Odyssey and how the gods behave in them, there's this constant, like, can we really believe that gods are this petty and this silly and this bullying? Is this something that we want to hold? Is this the standard that we want to hold up to our children as the higher power? It's also interesting. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, Mark Twain also said that God is a malign thug. Mm-hmm. And I think even the God of the Old Testament is just as much of a silly and willful character as any of the Greek gods.
Well, it's interesting. We get into this question of fantasy and science fiction too, in the nature of this debate, right? Because fantasy is a very weird place for religion, especially secondary fantasy worlds. What does it mean when you have a fantasy world where you've built up maybe a magic system so that, you know, people can cast certain kinds of magic and they can't cast other kinds of magic? And so you have another physics, essentially. And this is more and more true of modern fantasy stories. This is like the Brandon Sanderson tentpole story of the fantasy story in which you know how all of the magic works. In which case, it's basically a universe with special physics. And any gods that show up in the universe are also basically products of this sort of physical process. It's just the way that the world works that they happen to exist. So then you kind of challenge the whole notion of truth claim-based religion or miracle-based religion. If we say, we really like this guy because he can change water into wine, or because he can cause this this piece of meat to burst into flame or something like that, then you have to wonder, when there are people walking around who have the water into wine spell and the lightning bolt spell, like what's really all that important about this particular religion? So it seems almost to me like there's more of a impetus on fantasy writers who are working in secondary worlds to try to figure out what's actually relevant to the main characters or to religious characters in their stories about the religions that they practice, rather than just sort of this laundry list of truth claims.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, David.
I'd like to take a look at the term that you used, magic system. Mm-hmm. That a lot of writers really despise the term magic system. If mm-hmm. you have a magic system, then what you're writing is really kind of a role-playing game more than a fantasy. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I mean, there's a really powerful tradition of magic systems. And we have a lot of science fiction writers who became fantasy writers back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s who brought along that scientific attitude toward their fantasy. Sure. And so they wrote fantasy that had magic systems. Jack Vance was one of them. Powell Anderson was one of them. But the thing is, Tolkien was not one. Tolkien was coming not from a scientific tradition, but from a Christian tradition. He was a philosopher. He was a philosopher and a theologian.
Linguist.
And his magic system is no system at all. There's really very little magic in Lord of the Rings. What there is it's difficult to get a handle on. It is numinous. It has that quality of being. It is what it is. It is what it needs to be when it needs to be. And you can't just assemble your ingredients and chant your spells and have the effect. One of the other big differences between magic, you know, numinous, fantastic mm-hmm. magic, and magic that is merely a form of technology, mm-hmm. is the if anybody can perform the recipe, if anybody can pick up the spell and say the words and have the effect happen, then that's really a technology, even if it has the flavor of magic. But if it depends on who you are rather than what you have or what you do, then it's more magical and less science fictional. And you see that Harry Potter, for example, is kind of on the science fictional edge of fantasy in that the magic system is learnable, but at the same time, you have to be born to it. Muggles cannot do magic no matter how much they learn, no matter how many spells they might learn. And so, you know, that's one of the big breakpoints between science fiction and fantasy. And I think that's one of the breakpoints between science and religion as well, because religion is all about what happens internally, whereas science is about what can be measured. And what's been really interesting in the last 50 years is the degree to which we've been able to measure things that used to be internal, first with X-rays and then with MRIs and with various brain scans. So we can now actually see religious conversion happening in the brain, and we can argue over what we see and what it means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because of course we can now look at the sort of chemical reactions that are in your brain, and the brain is doing a lot of crazy stuff.
Sure.
It gets much more complicated too, because what we think we understand about how the brain works becomes suddenly, in a different kind of way, we suddenly realize we don't know as much as we thought at all. It's a strange smorgasbord of crazy inside our heads. And I mean, I've seen lots of discussions, and this is related to a religious discussion, but the question of free will, in the religious sense, the idea that God, or at least in a Christian religious sense, I can't speak for any other religions, I'm not very familiar with them, but in the Christian religious sense, God gives everyone, you know, free will. You can choose to follow God's law, or you can, you know, run around and like with a diaper on your head if that's what you feel like doing. And in a sort of biological sense, we're supposed to, at least at some basic level, have the ability to choose. But the more we learn about how the brain functions, it becomes a lot more difficult to figure out which parts are actually choices and which parts are influenced by other things going on in your brain, such that you make those choices because of those influences, not because you like consciously decided to do, you know, wear the diaper on your head or whatever. And I find that very interesting, because on some weird level, while we are learning more about the brain, science is also giving us this sort of terrifying uncertainty in some areas, on those very philosophical questions that I don't think people expected, or at least I didn't. Maybe I'm somewhat young, so maybe I'm naive, but I didn't expect that we would be having these kind of philosophical discussions within science. But yet here we are.
Well, we only think we think.
Thank you for making that even more scary.
Well, and Stephen Hawking, when he's talking about the beginning of the world, needs to address the Kantian antinomies, like the questions of whether it is actually possible to even think about a world being having a beginning in a scientific sense, or philosophical sense. It's really cool. And then also that notion of the difficulty of like pinpointing a point where the individual will starts, if we even want to talk about there being such a thing as an individual will, and the kind of collective network effect of a bunch of chemical stuff going on in our brains, input from outside, input from like other parts of our body, starts to look an awful lot like certain kinds of Buddhist and Hindu interpretations of the way that karma works. It's all really cool. I would like to say one thing about the Tolkien magic system and sort of numinous question, though. You're absolutely right that Tolkien never sort of sits down and says, do A and you get B, and do C and you get D. But it's very clear how the magic that shows up in the story and is going to be used to advance the plot in any way functions at every point along the line. The ring, you put it on, you turn invisible. If you put it on and you're like a terrifying, powerful enough person, then you can do crazy stuff with it, but it makes you go insane and everybody around it sort of falls to the dark side eventually. And so Tolkien is very good about, he's a great storyteller in that he's good about making clear what options are open to the characters at any given moment, what choices they can make. But then there's all of this other stuff that the main characters of the story never understand and that remains mystical to them.
What I would actually argue with your assertion that the powers of the ring are clearly delimited.
Delimited. Yeah. Right.
I mean, what are the powers of the rings?
Yeah.
You know, five rings, you know, seven rings for the elven kings under the sky, seven for the earth, for the dwarf lords and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, apart from the fact that these rings put the wearer under the control of the bearer of the controller ring, you know, of Sauron, what did they actually do?
There is an answer to that, but it involves doing all sorts of Silmarillion-y stuff that isn't relevant to the Lord of the Rings. I absolutely agree with you there. But when the ring is being used in the story, the ways that it can be used by the central characters are more clear. Like, Frodo doesn't have the option of all of the options that Sauron would have when he puts on the ring and then becomes master of Middle-earth. But he does know that if he puts on the ring, he can become invisible and become visible to Sauron off in the distance. But he can, like, slip by the orcs if he needs to. So there is at least an element of clarity for each of the characters about what they can and can't do, which I think is really important for dramatic storytelling, because otherwise it's like, oh, you know, magic, and then we magic our way out of this dilemma. It's a big risk for a writer anyway.
Yes. I guess that my question would be about the other rings. I mean, because I agree that the one ring, the one ring that rules them all and all this stuff, you know, we at least get a sense of like what it does. And so when you use it, you know, as you were saying, right, it has its own powers. But I always was curious, like, what was it about the other rings that made all of those people be like, yeah, let's get this. I want a ring. I want a magic ring. Because it seems to me that the characters who decide that, like the elves, I don't know. It seems to me the elves are these really very hyper-rational individuals. And I just feel like they would be naturally suspicious of someone offering them really pretty rings.
Well, we don't know what happened. We don't know what happened to the elf ring bearers. The human ring bearers became the ring wraiths. But we don't know what became of the dwarven or elvish ring bearers. They may have been smart enough to take the damn thing off and throw it away.
Well, we know what happened to all of the elven rings. Gandalf ends up with one of them, the Ring of Fire. Galadriel ends up with Narya, the Ring of Adamant. And then Elrond ends up with the Ring of Water, which he uses to do. No, or maybe it's the... whatever. So, yeah, those three guys count for the three rings. The dwarven rings, I think at some point it's mentioned that they all get eaten. All of the dwarves who have the rings get eaten by dragons, and so all of the dwarven rings are kind of a moot point in some dragon's belly somewhere. But
So in other words, you're saying they weren't very effective.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm really amused that the elves have, like, the Ring of Fire and the Ring of Water. I'm just waiting for you to say they also have the Ring of Heart and...
Yeah, the Ring of Spirit. And once into every generation, there is born one elf who can wear all of the rings of power, and he is the Avatar, and so forth.
So that's Dave, where Gandalf came from.
Dave, you had your hand up for quite a bit, so why don't you if you wanted to take us back to something or start up a new particular inquiry.
Well, maybe a bit of both, because it's still springing out of what we were just talking about with Tolkien and the distinction between his approach and the others. And one of the things we haven't really approached, and I think it's is the division between the approach to religion that is essentially a kind of outsider one, an anatomizing of it, seeing how it works and figuring it out, which is what we've been talking about, and I suspect is primarily how we all deal with it, versus someone like Tolkien, or even more, I think, explicitly C.S. Lewis, where the religion of the writer is shaping the story, and we get a, you know, everything from parable to proselytizing to, or maybe just we see its influence playing out, right? In whether you're going to get a magic system or simply the behavior of the characters, but the impact of the religion on the story itself, rather than the stories looking at the impact of religion.
Yeah, and that's actually a really interesting point. One of the things that I think is perhaps why the second film adaptation for the Chronicles of Narnia was so unsuccessful is that it ends with a basically the heroes get rescued by God, or the version of God that's in the Narnia, which is Aslan, which is kind of cool because he's a giant lion, whatever. But I do find it really interesting because, like, I like that film, but I understand why people did not like it, because you get to the end and your resolution is, you know, poof, God solved all the problems and we just had a giant flood and everybody's happy and that's it. And that's not nearly as, I think on some level, not nearly as compelling as, say, the end of Lord of the Rings, when even though people argue about why the eagles didn't just come earlier, but at the end you're watching your main characters and the various main characters, right? Aragorn and everyone, they're all struggling to do something to save the world, right? And they all have to suffer, right, and fight and, you know, shed blood and tears and all this stuff to get there. Yeah. Frodo more than anybody because of the toll the ring takes on him, the psychological toll. So that we see that. So there is no, like, magic and, like, all the world is solved, even though I guess technically the eagles could have come and done it earlier. But
they're
eagles.
There were flying dinosaurs that were all over Mordor and then they all died. But yeah, sure. It's cool.
But there is that kind of, I guess that what Dave was saying, the way in which I guess the author's religion perhaps influenced the construction of the story, so that within I guess a very Christian like a Christian milieu, that makes sense for the Narnia books as being influenced from that to also borrow those same sorts of things that you would find in the Bible as an example, right? Because of course that kind of stuff happens quite frequently in the Bible. God intervenes at, you know, important moments, presumably important moments. I mean, we don't know what he's doing like every day, but I mean, he's probably out there building suns or something, but he does, he intervenes, right? He has the flood, in which he, you know, wipes mankind, which was kind of sucks. You know, he stops people from doing certain acts that they're, you know, he's asked them to do. He does horrible things to Job, as a way of kind of a best, like a strange bet with the devil, which is weird. But these things that he's intervening, but that's part of that system, I guess. I think that's a terrible way of putting it, but so it fits within, I guess, the Narnia worldview, whereas something like that does not fit into, like, it wouldn't make any sense that go through, you know, however many words and pages of that book, and then we get to the last five pages and Tolkien's like, oh yeah, and Tom Bombadil showed up and won, right? That would be like the most anticlimactic ending, and it would have bombed. But I see, Max, you had your hand up.
It's a literal deus ex machina.
Yeah,
exactly.
Bombadil shows up. Well, it's really interesting because I think this ties into different ways that both Tolkien and Lewis, as two like super awesome Christian fantasists, relate to their own religion. Lewis is a big time apologist, right? He's got Mere Christianity and whole bunches of books about the Christian religion and sort of justifications of it. And I feel like when we start reading Narnia, sometimes we're reading him going through a checklist of like, I need to present this religion in this appropriate way, including a lot of these sort of doctrinal elements and these parallels to the other stories. Whereas Tolkien, I think, was really interested in faith. He's a deep believer. He's interested in faith in what I'd call using Paul Tillich's terminology, a sort of ultimate concern kind of way. Tillich has this another. I'm sorry, I'm bringing out a lot of theology here. This is like a pastime of mine. Tillich has this definition of faith as a state of being ultimately concerned. You kind of take something and you center your entire sort of life around it. It's more than even just a personality or a sort of, or a consciousness. It's the way that you act, move, behave, respond. And so the thing in which you have faith stands at the center of your spirit, stands at the center of your being. And then everything you do springs out of that. It's like spinning a top on its point. And so the ultimate concern would be the point. And so all over Tolkien, we see shades what I'd call it, like a Christian consciousness. Nothing great is won without sacrifice or pain. Everything requires a great deal of suffering and the comprehension of suffering, awareness of the value of meekness and humility and determination in the face of overwhelming adversity. becomes much more of an asset than raw power. And even raw power gets used against itself over and over and over again. And these are all very sort of Christian ways of approaching a world. And he goes through them and he does them all. And I think one of the beautiful elements of Lord of the Rings is how seamlessly it becomes a part of this world that he's created, such that you can't do the thing that you can do as an adult who kind of gets the joke of the Narnia books, where you go back and you're like, oh, that comes from 1 Corinthians, and that bit over there is a reference to this passage in the New Testament, and this thing is, oh, and then it's the stone table, so we have a cross, and that guy's basically doing the Judas thing, and okay, I see where we are here. It's just different approaches to the universe.
Correct
to the creation
me if I'm wrong.
Universes. Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Narnia written explicitly as a Bible story for children?
C.S. Lewis called it a supposal. Like, let's suppose that we have a parallel universe in which we have talking animals, and further, let's suppose that my Christian religion, which is true, is also true in that universe. What would it look like? So we have a lion, and so the lion would need to die and rise again, and that kind of thing. So.
And Tolkien famously,
Go ahead.
I was just going to say Tolkien famously said to Lewis about his about Narnia, "This just won't do."
Yeah.
Although I guess there's some wonderfulness about the fact that the Aslan is played by Liam Neeson, who's honestly, I didn't expect that his voice would work so well, but he really pulls off giant lion god. So. It's sort of like there are some actors that I feel like really fit their role as God, like Morgan Freeman as God and Bruce Almighty. Like, it's hard not to just think that, oh, that's what God looks like now. In an amazing way.
Now I'm imagining Aslan in Taken.
Well, we did have him in the Star Wars prequel.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And then they killed him.
And then they killed him. And he rose again.
He did, right.
Yeah, so.
Blue
Ghost. No, okay.
At least the Kraken, so.
I think what's going on here is that I think Tolkien works better than Narnia. Lord of the Rings works better than Narnia, because those things that you're identifying as being particularly Christian in terms of nothing worthwhile happens except through suffering and kindness. And that's not just Christian, that's good storytelling.
Yeah.
And I would actually take a big step back and claim that that stuff is all in the Bible because, well, it's not in the Bible because it makes a good story, but it's in the Bible and it's in the stories for the same reason, which is how our psychology works. But that's obviously an explicitly non-religious way of looking at the question. But I think that Tolkien had a better grasp of story than Lewis did. Lewis was just taking stuff that had already been written and basically was writing fanfic. He was repurposing existing plots and situations
furry
and rewriting
Jesus
them.
Fanfic.
Furry Jesus
angry
fanfic.
Email
absolutely.
About that.
Yeah. But here's the thing is that I bounced off of Narnia because I couldn't buy the premises. It didn't seem to make sense to me because I wasn't already swimming in that fishbowl. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the Bible doesn't make a lot of sense to me either. But let's take a look at Gene Wolfe. And I bring up Gene Wolfe because there's a couple of Gene Wolfe books right at eye level on the bookshelf in front of me. But still, I have often completely failed to understand Gene Wolfe's short fiction because I didn't catch the reference. There are several Gene Wolfe stories which are very highly regarded that I can't even figure out what's going on. The ending doesn't make any sense. The character relationships don't make any sense.
Yeah.
And it's because I'm lacking in this case, not the religious belief necessarily, but the philosophy background, the introduction to certain key concepts in discussion of that particular branch of religion rather than the religious belief itself.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I think that is something that shows up with Wolfe a lot. And it's even not just with religion. He's a very elusive writer. A book like... oh gosh, I'm forgetting the name of it. The Evil Guest, which is the one, the sort of neo-noir Cthulhu set in 200 years in the future, but there are trains, but there's theater. And anyway, like that one, which would, in addition to not making sense if you didn't know a whole bunch of stuff about certain religions, also doesn't make much sense unless you know a whole bunch of stuff about Lovecraft, for example, and unless you're quite familiar with like noir tropes. He does that a ton, and it's definitely one of the aspects of his writing, maybe weaknesses, maybe strengths. I don't know. I don't feel even qualified to comment on Gene Wolfe sometimes.
Well, I think that just because it was the first author, I think, that you mentioned, Max, is another author that is very similar, someone like Salman Rushdie, where I won't speak to the Satanic Verses because I've only read it sort of half-assedly once, so sure. I can't speak to it, but I can speak to Midnight's Children, which, if you don't know, I mean, you could probably read it and it would be sort of make sort of sense if you read it. But if you don't understand the context of the founding of the Indian nation, and that this idea of, you know, the stroke of midnight, so all of these Midnight's Children are people that are born literally at midnight at the birth of the India as its own country, as a free country, and the other references that are there, historical references, and he intentionally gets some of the references wrong, which if you don't know the actual years and stuff, like, you miss it. I missed it the first time I read it because I didn't know. I had a teacher point it out to me, and I was like, oh, that's weird. But it's one of those books where without that undercurrent, a lot of the sort of pieces to it don't have quite the impact. And even though this isn't about religion, I think that it's still kind of an important component of storytelling that I don't know how really good fiction can do that really well. I think Midnight's Children is a really excellent book. But I think there's also some aspect of that goes towards a work that is readable beyond just that first time. Is the kind of work where every time you go back to it, you actually discover things you didn't know, in part because maybe you've actually grown. So like something like 1984, every time I read that book, I catch things I never knew before, because I read it first in high school, and then I read it out of high school, and then I read it a few years later when I was slightly older. And the same thing with Midnight's Children. When you reread it again, you pick up stuff, or you know, other works, like perhaps with Gene Wolfe's works. I'm assuming that's the case. So
Gene Wolfe is one of those authors that people talk about being an author for rereading, like coming back and back to. So I'm looking forward to my next attempt at the Book of the New Sun for that reason.
Somebody once, there's a study guide for Book of the New Sun online, which I have tried to use and gotten bogged down in looking for answers to questions. One of which is, draw Severian's family tree, which is, it's very difficult at best. And and I found it impossible, which is interesting because you'd think that would be something you'd be able to do. I have a sneaking suspicion I know who his mother is. I have no idea who his father is, and neither one is explicitly stated in any of the books.
Right.
That's interesting. That's usually a red flag whenever you get a study guide, and that's the question. Draw the family tree, and it's like, well, I know that's going to be a tough one.
Question, the harder the answer. Yeah.
My wife always draws whenever there's like, especially a mystery with any kind of relations in it. She will usually wind up writing a family tree in the end papers of the book. And often she discovers that as she's drawing this family tree, she discovers a blatant hole, which is, okay, so that indicates that this person over here is actually an uncle and doesn't know it. And of course, that turns out to be the resolution to the plot. So sometimes doing that sort of thing can be a spoiler. You can actually spoil yourself.
Oh, that's awesome. That's cool. It doesn't always work, though. There's a famous, I think this is a Raymond Chandler story, though I don't know about what book it is, where he, you know, wrote this book, and then several years later, someone came back and asked him, yeah, so who killed the butler in this particular book?
It's the big sleep.
All right. Excellent. So he said, I don't really know. I forgot that guy.
It was when they were doing the film, and at one point, the director lost track of, the chauffeur, who killed the chauffeur? So he asked Faulkner, who wrote the screenplay, and Faulkner didn't know. So they called Chandler, and Chandler apparently just blew them off, saying the butler did it. To which I think it was Hawks who was directing and said, "Well, no, the butler couldn't have done it. He was in the greenhouse at the time." And there is a murder in that movie that you never find out.
That's awesome.
See, I think that's part of the noir attitude toward life is, you know, sometimes people just die, okay?
Get over it.
You expect there to be an explanation for everything?
Well, and that's what makes it numinous.
Right, yeah.
And speaking of harking back to previous topics, I'd like to hark back to the topic of... Oh, Lordy, I've lost it. I'm sorry. I'll remember it later.
That's fine. Well, why don't we take a moment and actually talk about David and Max, your works, because obviously, Max, I think you have a book coming somewhat soon, and David, you actually have a short story in a collection which is coming out soon. So why don't we start just to go on the science fiction side first. Let's actually start talking about this Old Mars collection of which you're a part, David. It's a collection edited by George R. R. Martin, which awesome, and Gardner Dozois.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Old Mars is an anthology of stories set on Mars the way it used to be before all that pesky science got in the way. So all of these stories are about versions of Mars that are more exciting than the actual Mars that we got. Although the actual Mars that we got is cool in its own way. It doesn't have Martians. It doesn't have canals. And so this is a whole book of stories about Mars the way it should have been, with a deliberately retro attitude, and there's a whole bunch of really good writers in it, and I kind of got in by the skin of my teeth, and I'm very glad to be there. And actually, the story that I wrote in there is taken from a universe that I've been working on for a while. I've got a novel in that universe, which is just about ready to begin submission. And there's another story set in Venus of that universe, which is looking for a home right now.
And what I find interesting, the story, if I think I have the title correctly, is The Wreck of the Mars Adventure.
Yes.
And it actually involves Captain Kidd.
Yes, Captain Kidd. It takes place in 1702, and it is the story of the first Englishman on Mars, which is Captain William Kidd. Yes, the famous pirate.
I have a book that you need to check out, because it's not doing exactly what this is doing, but it has some similar kind of... playing around with the idea of people in old times actually doing space adventures. It's a book by Mike Martinez called The Daedalus Incident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was sitting next to him at a panel at the Worldcon, and I wrote that book title down. I have to pick it up and read it.
It's pretty cool. It's got old ships of the line having battle in space.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool. But so tell us a little bit about the story, other than the fact that it takes place in the early 1700s and it has Captain Kidd.
Well, this starts off, basically this takes place in an alternate universe in which everything is the same as here, except that the solar system is full of air, which means that it's possible to get to Mars and Venus by balloon. And I started off with the idea that I was going to make this one impossible change and then have the rest of it be hard science, because I don't know if you're familiar with the Viriconia series. The Queen of Candace, Son of Suns. I'm blanking on the author's name at the moment.
Schroeder?
Schroeder. Yes. So this is a hard science fiction story that takes place in a fairly low tech world where everybody's floating around in this enormous envelope of air, but it is entirely hard science fiction. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to take that and transport it into the past because the past is cool, and into our solar system because people are more interesting. And it turns out that you can't actually do that, that when you fill the solar system with air, an awful lot of stuff stops working, that the surface of the Earth, for example, is scoured clean by 10,000 mile per hour winds from the rotating Earth in the atmosphere. So, and also the sun would just be sort of a vague glow off in that direction, because air really isn't all that transparent when you pile up that much of it in one place. And this is something that Schroeder dealt with, and I decided to hand wave around it instead. So in the end, my story, although I'm trying to treat it like science fiction, I'm trying to treat the premise science fictionally, it's really a fantasy. But I hope that it's a technologically flavored fantasy. I want it to be steampunky without being steampunk, because the reason it isn't steampunk to me is that it takes place in the 1800s, in the early 1800s, which is pre-steam. Sorry, the novel takes place in the early 1800s. The short story takes place in the early 1700s. In either case, it's pre-steam, so I don't consider it steampunk. But it has a lot of that steampunk vibe in that it's history with a twist.
It's, I just, I'm amazed that you actually sat there and you're like, well, if I just fill the space with air, what happens? And you find out, yeah,
it doesn't
work.
Dead. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you take a look at XKCD What If online, you'll find that the answer to just about every question that people ask of Randall is eventually everybody dies.
So what is it for you? I mean, obviously you submitted a story for this, so you have some sort of love for Mars as it might have once been conceived. So what is it for you that is so fascinating about Mars?
Well, Mars is cool because it's the most reachable alien planet, or the most alien reachable planet, as it were. That Mars is as close as we've got in this solar system to a twin planet to the Earth. It is very, very similar to the Earth. If you take away all of the water and half of the atmosphere and two-thirds of the rock from Earth, you'd get Mars. And Mars has appealed to the human imagination long before the invention of writing. Because it is like a star, but it's not the same color as a star, and it doesn't move as a star. And so people have been interested in Mars since long before we knew it was a planet. And with the invention of telescopes and such, it became even more interesting. And so people have been interested in Mars for a long, long time. And I'm interested in it not only because of the cool things about Mars itself, but because there's so much history of fiction around Mars. I mean, I just love Mars. I've written so many different Marses in my various pieces of short and long fiction. And I even spent 2 weeks on a simulated Mars base in Utah.
Oh, nice.
Whoa.
Cool.
Yeah. We had fake spacesuits and everything.
Really?
Serious.
You haven't got the record, though. That record goes to those guys that stayed in that facility out in the middle of the desert for like 300 bazillion days.
Yeah. Well, there's actually I have a connection there, because one of the six people on my crew, this is the Mars base is owned by the Mars Society, which is a nonprofit. And there's six people changing every 2 weeks. One of the people in my six person crew was a guy named Diego Urbina, who was, while we were there in Utah, he got the email saying that he was a semifinalist for the Russian Mars 500-day expedition. And so he went from Utah straight to Moscow, and he went through another couple of rounds of selection, and eventually he was selected. So he spent 500 days locked in a tin can with five other guys on a pretend voyage to Mars without ever leaving a laboratory in Moscow. And he was actually one of the two that, quote unquote, went down to the surface and actually stepped out on the surface of Mars. So he's come about as close as anybody has to actually traveling to Mars and back.
That's pretty incredible.
Wow. And he survived.
And he survived. I would hope so.
Yeah.
That would not have been a good news story.
Well, one of the first
Russian experiment.
Yeah. Well, they did a 100-day and a 300-day before the full 500-day experiment. And the 100-day experiment, they had a mixed gender crew, men and women. And there was so much tension between the men and the women that I don't know that they actually called the expedition off, but it was a near thing. And what they chose to do in response to that near disaster was they made subsequent crews to be all male. And I think that was the wrong decision.
Yeah, I mean, they really should. I know that the Russians are really interesting in that, because I think they're the only ones who've done studies on sex and space.
I don't think anybody's actually studied sex and in space and published. Well, I mean, there's lots of speculation, but nothing official.
The pool of experimental subjects is so small, it would be hard to maintain anonymity.
Didn't they send a bunch of people up and were like, you're going to do it? Or maybe it was like one of those hoax stories.
I think that's fiction.
Oh, man, that was such a cool story when it came out. Dang it. I was really excited about that. For reasons that now that I say that out loud, it makes me sound very perverted. So I'm just going to shut up.
It's a fascinating topic.
Well, I mean, it is a weird question. How do you have sex in space?
Because mm-hmm. you're bumping into everything.
Right. Like, I think there was one guy who invented some sort of weird harness, which...
I do remember a story on Boing Boing about the weird harness.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you just get used to it, but...
It's not one of those issues that has really been pressing on us, right? It's like, okay, how do we manage to pull this off?
We're going to send people to Mars. That's what, like a 6 to 8 month journey?
Well, 500 days there and back, right?
500 days round trip, yeah. And that one's actually unreasonably short. they basically simulated the shortest possible mission.
Yeah, so I mean that the real mission would probably be considerably longer because that depends on orbits and where everything is. And
it happens that basically you can do it in 500 days if you don't spend any time at all in the vicinity of Mars. If you come, if basically you get there and you come straight back, which is really a terrible waste of time. But the way the orbital mechanics works is you can stay there for no time at all, or you can stay there for 2 years. It's really tough to stay there for a short amount of time.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Okay. Well, now I know. So when I go on Elon Musk's trip to Mars, it'll be good. Good for me to know how long I'll be gone.
That's something that you should definitely try to nail down before you pay for the ticket.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. And most likely he'll just send us there and not get us back. Just shoot us off into space and we'll be dead. So, which, I don't know. Depending on where I am in life, I might be okay with that. That because then I'd be the one that went to Mars and that'd be cool. But anyway, so Max, you have a very different kind of series. You have your second book is coming out, I think, pretty darn quick here. So why don't you talk a little bit about the first book and the kind of the series that you're putting together here of sort of urban fantasy secondary world novels?
Sure. So the first book, Three Parts Dead, like I said, it's about a junior associate at an international necromancy firm trying to resurrect a dead god. I'm not very good at like quick pitches, but a friend of mine pitched it to another friend as "Some gods are too big to fail," and I just loved that one so much that I stuck with it. And the kind of supposal in this world is that imagine that you have kind of real gods in a sort of urban context. They would be responsible for doing a lot of stuff. You know, you pray to them, and then they kind of would maintain the city that you're living in. In this case, we have a city that has a fire god, and he's responsible for dealing with like heat and power generation and all of that stuff for the city. So when some bad stuff happens and he dies, this is a pretty big problem. Now, fortunately, there are a bunch of very competent international necromancy firms that are perfectly willing to swing through and, you know, cut open your dead god and take out the stuff that isn't working and wire the rest of it back together and stitch him up again and hook him up to the lightning generator and tell Igor to get cranking. And then pretty soon you have, you know, zombie god walking around to take care of most of the stuff that's actually important to you, or the minimal stuff that's important to you, like the power and the heat without which millions of people are going to die this winter, but might not actually take care of a lot of the kind of softer and gentler aspects of divine faith, like, you know, actual grace and communion with a higher power and all that kind of thing. And the story came off of basically the financial crash in 2008, when I had this intimation. I'd just come back from China and I was wandering around and seeing the world, looking for work, having a good time. And then basically the U.S. economy tripped and stumbled and fell into a meat grinder. And then there was economy bits everywhere. And so it was interesting to watch the sheer amount of fear in like news anchors' eyes and to wander around law school. My wife was in law school at the time, and listen to the kinds of conversations, the kinds of sort of existential questions that were being raised by this failure of a system that had been assumed to be, if not perfect, like at least very strong and not susceptible to this kind of systematic trouble. So it looked like a crisis of faith from the outside. And then one of the things that was starting to happen, so you had this this affair in which you had immense immortal entities that survived basically based on people's confidence in them on a day-to-day basis, who had suddenly all died, and then we were running around trying to pick up the pieces. It was like you'd had a war on a spiritual plane. So that was a nice image, and then I ran with that and ended up with this story, which is also using a lot of concepts from bankruptcy law, which after all works very similar to necromancy. You take something that's dead, you cut it open, you know, take all of the non-working stuff out, and then lightning and so forth. Right? Pretty straightforward.
Yes, that's exactly how bankruptcy works.
No, I mean it is. Like, it's not personal bankruptcy, although personal bankruptcy gets a little bit weird, but a sort of Chapter 11, a big corporate bankruptcy, you have this thing that's dead or dying, and you need to take out pieces of it in order to have the thing working again, even in some very minimal, basic context. You take out stuff that you can't afford, and a lot of that stuff is really important for the people who are connected with the bankrupt entity. It could be things like a pension plan. It could be things like guaranteed employment for some people or tenure, that kind of stuff. But what's left over, you know, it may get the planes from place to place or not in the case of like a bankruptcy for an airline, or it may keep the lights on in the case of a power company. But there may be a pretty significant change of the way that people relate to the firm itself. So anyway, that was kind of what was going on with Three Parts Dead. And then Two Serpents Rise is set in the same world. And one of the setting elements that it introduced to the world in the first book was this notion of a war between gods and sort of human wizards, that like basically people had figured out how to do the same kinds of things that gods do. And that was the sort of magic in the world. And there had been a war that ended in a very uneasy truce. So I wanted to explore what a city looked like that had successfully kicked its gods out, where basically people were running the entire thing in this kind of magical way. So Two Serpents Rise is set in this desert city that about 80 years ago, there was a revolution and they kicked out all of their gods, who are relatively sort of bloodthirsty, human sacrifice dependent kind of folks. And the problem is, though, you have a desert city. They were relying on the gods for a lot of rain and for a lot of other sort of support. So then the wizards needed to step in and take control and figure out where all of the water was going to come from. They managed to stabilize the situation using a bunch of magic that was really environmentally devastating to their surrounding area. But the city's basically working. Only problem is now, several decades later, the magic is starting to break down. People are poisoning it. There's some signs that loyalists to the old kicked out gods are working against the city. And a risk manager for the water utility, which is run by this crazy old Lich King who kicked out all of the old gods, this risk manager is trying to figure out what's going on, stop it, and kind of protect the city against imminent destruction. So, there's sort of bit of a Chinatown element going on there in a fantasy world. I had somebody describe the book to me as, "There's, damn it, Jake, it's fantasy land." So, so that's Two Serpents Rise. Oh, and the main character, Caleb, the risk manager, is having a lot of trouble because, for one thing, the witnesses that he's chasing after are having a really hard time staying in one place and not disappearing. And for another thing, his father is actually one of the last of the priests of the old gods who's still around and is opposed to the work that he's doing and the people that he's working for. And so Caleb's faced not only with this basically save this city, but is the city worth saving in the way that it's been operating so far? And is the life that we have right now, that his people have right now, worth the cost of it? So yeah, good fun stuff.
I like how, based on some of the earlier stuff we were talking about, like with something David was suggesting, when you describe your world, Max, it is very much, it feels almost like a very rigorously invented world, that just the way in which everything operates, everything has a cause and effect. This is kind of almost scientific in its approach. And I do find it also very fascinating that you've essentially just admitted that it's a metaphor for the 2008.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, you know, it starts with, it's not exactly a Roman Eclef. Like, you can't go through it and say, you know, who exactly is the CEO of AIG in this universe. But it was inspired by the notion that our entire capitalist system is basically a fantasy system with incredibly complicated rules. Or a magic system with incredibly complicated rules. And then the question, like David was actually bringing up, of the fact that a system like that fails to capture so much that's really important to storytelling, to characters, to ourselves as human beings, this notion of the numinous, of like ontological significance to our everyday lives and of the building of a community, starts to slip through the cracks of this apparently very rigorous system. So that's actually one of the things that I'm exploring with all of these books, the question of, so you have this rigorous system that seems to explain everything, but does so with an immense amount of violence to the world around it, to the people who live within it. But it allows for sort of marvels and developments that would not have been possible 100 years ago or several hundred years ago, and may arguably be slightly better than the general war of all against all that preceded it. So, question mark. And then you have a bunch of people who are running around trying to figure out, well, is this as good as we can do? Is there a better world that we can build?
Excellent. Well, this sounds very, very fascinating.
Cool. I'm glad you think so.
And it's starting to make sense now why you got nominated for a certain award. So,
yay! That was fun. That was a big surprise too. It was one of those. The Campbell nomination was one of those. I was sitting down. I didn't even know the nominations were coming out in a week. I was like, oh, you know, reading a book, trying to think about what I'm going to do for my next book, and then email. What? They just sent me an email. By the way, you've been nominated for the... Really? Please confirm. Okay.
I do the same thing if I ever get nominated for anything. It's like, are you sure you got Sean Duke, not someone named Sean Duque? You know,
yeah, someone who's like me, but better in every respect and every way.
That's kind of a natural fear, I think, for writers, right? The worry that you're not as good as you hope you are.
Oh, the fraud syndrome, I think, is almost universal.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's a necessary part of getting better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is people who believe that they are people who believe they're as good as all that don't work to improve, and therefore they never get as good as they think they are. Whereas people who are convinced that they're not nearly as good as ever the people think they are, and I certainly every writer I know falls into that trap, and myself included, they just keep working to better themselves, and they actually do become as good as people think they are.
It keeps you honest.
Right. And you're constantly trying to do better. You're you know, you look at your work and you go, that's not the best I can do. Right. It kind of goes to one of those things when people talk about, you know, I keep going back and editing that short story. At some point, I just have to just submit it. But, you know, in 20 years, if that thing is published, you'll look back and go, yeah, it wasn't that good.
Aikido, there's this concept of like the ground never lies to you. So you can't fake good ukemi. You can't fake like a good roll or a good fall, because if you tried to fake it, then you will hit hard and you'll feel it in 5 minutes and then the next day. And I think that's something that writing really lacks. There's that sort of terror of you're never entirely certain whether to trust a reader's response to a story. And maybe this reader just really likes the particular way that you messed up. And so, the next reader is going to be the one who calls you out. So that inveterate fear is maybe useful, but it's probably not all that psychologically healthy either. I don't know.
Well, maybe, but unfortunately we're just smack out of time, and I want to make sure not to kill David's battery or make it so that Max is not fashionably late anymore, but so late that he misses everything that he's going to be going to. So I want to thank Max and David for coming on the show, talking about your work, and also for the very interesting discussion surrounding religion and genre fiction. That was very interesting. So thank you, Max.
Thank you so much, Sean.
And thank you, David. Dave.
Thank you very much.
Yep. And Dave, obviously, thank you for being my co-host today.
Thank you very much.
Cool. And we will see everybody with the next episode. Toodles.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I pass in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.